Thanks. What a great presentation. Pretty, really good. Very impressive. Well, we didn't talk about these things a couple of years ago. And yeah, the province has changed. I'll give you an example. I was appointed to the board of BC Hydro this week. The first architect ever on the board of BC Hydro. So if you do buildings in British Columbia, get ready for some change. I'm going to talk about three specific buildings and what we've learned about trying to chase a position of carbon neutrality for those buildings. So it's a kind of a lessons learned. These are the three greenest things that are at the point where we can discuss them at the moment. I think there's interest. Some of you might have seen some of these projects before, but I'll try to review them from the point of view of talking about the energy and the carbon neutrality to it. As a preface, I guess, we see environmental buildings as much larger than carbon neutrality, and there's, you know, the ecological footprint is a very significant measure of the right to full set of criteria. The fact that we've dropped into a shorthand now of talking about carbon neutrality and energy efficiency is very important for one particular issue. So without denigrating that, I just do want to put it in the context of the fact that there are so many other very, very important challenges that we face as architects and engineers for buildings, water, ecological balances, biodiversity. There's so many other issues. But today we're going to concentrate on carbon issues. This chart represents the energy performance of a range of buildings starting in the late 90s to the present time, measured against ASHRAE 90.1. And these are energy consumption remaining, in other words, a 40% reduction, 50% reduction, 60% reduction, and so on. So these are built and operational buildings. In the case of the left-hand side, for the three recent ones, these are the buildings that we're talking about here today, GM Place, Dockside, and CSRS, measured against that chart. Since it's a sharp audience, I will qualify ASHRAE 90.1 here as relative because, of course, that standard has been changing during the same period of time, so don't catch me out. So it's measured against them on a relative a point of view. I guess what we're saying here is that since the late 90s, right through for the last say 10 years, it's been relatively easy for us to reduce energy consumption by 50-60%.
Sorry, Peter, that's my problem.
You're dead. Offset you.
Perhaps anyone else who has a cell phone could turn it off at this point.
James Danzy.
I'm just glad it didn't ring in my presentation.
Oh, I got a funny story. I'll tell you. Very short.
Uh-oh.
That happened to me in an audience once at McGill. There were 400 people there, and phone rang, and I calmly waited and everything, and then... Please don't do that again. Everybody's off. Yes, no problem. And then mine rang in my shirt. I couldn't hide. Anyway, so the point here is that there's plenty of practice and experience in British Columbia and other places, certainly in Cascadia, as to how to reduce energy consumption in buildings 50-60%. That seems to be an attainable goal for most projects at the moment without significant additional capital cost, blah, blah, blah. How do we get beyond that if carbon neutrality is down here? How do we get beyond that? And, you know, what's involved in going the next step? And there are – it's a gear shift change. It's a significant change. So a couple of examples. First of all, the Center for Interactive Research on Sustainability often presented a 4.5-year-old project at this time. It has recently, finally, been approved by the board for UBC, so this will actually get built. Not in exactly the same form that's here, but because it's on a different site now and we have to redesign it as it's going out to UBC. Nonetheless, the vision stays the same. And the product will, or the final building will achieve the goals that we've set out, perhaps even better in the way it's configured in this particular presentation. So the The building seeks to be the best performer in North America. It also seeks to learn from itself over time and adapt. It seeks to be a demonstration project that's available to professionals and the public, so it sets a leadership position in everything it does. This is the list of goals that it has, and you can see that we did set out as a goal initially to be GHG neutral, carbon neutral in design. And we sought to do that as in the design of the actual project itself, not necessarily with offsets initially. There are lots of other goals here, just the broader net again, 100% live off the rainwater that lands on it, look after its own waste, zero waste, both liquid and solid, and provide a very healthy air quality interior. So there are a whole set of site strategies related to green roofs and bioswales for treatment and even urban agriculture, as well as an examination of the flora and fauna on site and the ecological balances before and after. In terms of energy systems, natural ventilation systems throughout underfloor, displacement ventilation, ground source geothermal as an energy source, no fans, very advanced strategies in every regard. 100% daylighting. There's still very few buildings in North America that are lit 100% by daylight during operations. When the sun is out, we chose to try and find a design that maximized that. In fact, indeed, it met 100% of the areas. Rainwater collection and reuse as a demonstration, but also as a practical and easily attainable reality here in British Columbia and on the Pacific Northwest. Wastewater treatment and collection on a display basis for others to see and learn on site. And in terms of the energy systems themselves, ground source, and then radiant slabs system throughout the project with underfloor air delivery. So there's a displacement, there's a flywheel effect on the thermal mass through heavy concrete, and then the displacement ventilation captures that and brings it into the working environment, and then that exits out of the atriums themselves. Very, very efficient envelope, extremely efficient envelope, very careful sun control around the perimeter, reduced the need for a lot of energy. And you can see in this illustration as well two sources of renewable energy, photovoltaics on the skylights here as part of the sun screening, but energy generation, and on the south wall, solar hot water heating tubes that would then feed the hot water system, preheat the hot water system, but also provide heating for the radiant system in the slabs. And then finally, the idea that the building should be extremely healthy through control of the ventilated air and oxygenation of it through microfiltration. There was a whole connected strategy around building maintenance and operations so that the building wouldn't be seen as a finished entity ever, that it would go on and roll on and learn from and grow and improve over time, and that would be part of a community of learning from an academic point of view as well as a public and point of view. So here's what actually happened. Again, measured against ASHRAE 90.1. We got the envelope and the performance, energy performance of the building down to 84% below ASHRAE 90.1. So that's a significant improvement over that cluster of buildings that I've shown you that we've done over the last 10 or 15 years or so. So by concentrating on absolutely maximizing performance and everything we know, we can get that low. Which is pretty good, and that's the kind of thing you see in the super insulated buildings in Sweden and Scandinavia and Germany, those ultra deep wall high performance buildings that are there. then the building itself has some energy generation capability. About 7% of the total, offsetting a chunk of the remaining energy consumption. The problem in British Columbia is that and the Pacific Northwest actually, is we don't get enough sun. We know that, don't we? When we need energy, unlike buildings in the desert, when we need energy in the wintertime, it's not there for us. The sun is not there for us. So it's inherently efficient to do a renewable generation in hot, dry climates, but it's less inherently sensible to do them here with limited resources because the solar radiation is just not there for us. Notwithstanding that, we probably should be doing it on our buildings. We shouldn't be relying on it solely. But this gives you an idea about what we thought was appropriate for this particular building. So the remaining load is 9% of the total normal load. So we didn't make it. We didn't make it to GHG neutrality through design. And we are proposing to buy offsets for the remainder, 9%. So that's the story of that building. We tried and we got there. I dare say that building could get to zero on its own without offsets in pretty well any other climate in Canada. There is certainly enough solar radiation in Calgary, in the prairies, in Ottawa, in Montreal, and Toronto to achieve that goal. Perhaps not in Halifax. I think that equation will change when the cost of renewables changes, when the cost of $10 a watt at the moment for PV, when that drops by a zero or a decimal point, as we would expect it to do in the next 3 or 4 years, then that equation will change. So perhaps the net zero energy building is certainly going to be quite achievable with the reduction in renewable prices in 3 to 4 years here and in British Columbia. And if we can do it here, we can do it anywhere because we get so little sun. Here's another building, a much more commercial building. It's an office building for the Aquilini Group adjacent to GM Place. It's on a wedge of a site that's GM Place is here. The Vancouverites will know GM Place is the place where we play hockey for the others. And there's a viaduct next to it, and there's a triangular site. And we designed a building that wants to be distinguished in the marketplace as the healthiest workplace, and that then led us to a very green approach to the design supported by the owners that led to a very high-performance building. Chief among the many energy reduction strategies is the daylighting strategy. This is a very recently completed Vancouver office building showing daylight penetration, as you might expect, 6 or 7 meters in from glazing. Here's the strategy in the GM Place project. So you can see we've organized both light shelves and daylighting systems on the perimeter to increase the depth. But we've also organized all of the core functions that don't require daylight in the center and all the workspaces at the perimeter. And that's a strategy that would reduce, in British Columbia, buildings consume electrical energy for lighting consumes 31% of the energy consumed in buildings at the moment in British Columbia. So the strategy can knock a significant amount of that away. And you can see the light shelf strategy, shading device, light shelf strategy here at the perimeter, plus high-performance insulation panels and a degree of screening on the glazing at the perimeter. So it's a sophisticated envelope, but it is a commercial building. This is being done for commercial lease rates. So it's an economic reality that CERS doesn't have to bend to. So it's achievable. Course operable windows, radiant panel systems, in this case in the ceiling, because it's a cooling driven building, we want radiant from the ceilings. Ground source again, of course, small capillary radiant systems throughout the building. Interestingly enough, for the architects in the room, that system reduces the floor to floor dimension, and the investment in this high performance heating and cooling system was more than offset by the three additional stories that we could put into the building because of this reduction. So that's another economic argument for why this building could be so green. we realized that there was an amazing opportunity next door, the co-ownership. So this is how we get to carbon neutral. This is an energy-efficient building, but it's not carbon neutral in and of itself. What's going on next door, of course, GM Place requires a lot of heat. And at the moment, it draws its heat from central steam, which is gas-fired, which is one of the largest carbon emitters in the center of the city at the moment, central steam. So we could take the waste heat from our building, because it's an office building, it generates heat most of the time, and we can dump it into GM Place and heat GM Place for free. So then we're offsetting an energy consumption and an emission profile next door. In addition, they scrape the ice in GM Place, and they're actually using hot water pipes to melt the scraped ice that piles up, so we can in fact run our chilling tubes from the building down through the place where they melt the ice at the end of the rink, and we can get free cooling for the office building. In addition, when they make ice, it dumps waste heat. During the nighttime and early in the morning, an office building needs heat, so we can actually take that waste heat output from ice generation and use it to heat the office building when we need it. So there's an interesting synergy between the two buildings, and lo and behold, that synergy allows us to claim that this building will be the first carbon neutral building because of the offsetting that it does. So here's your typical office tower in terms of kilowatt hours per square meter per year. This is a currency of measuring buildings. If you're not familiar with it now, you're going to be familiar with it. It's coming soon from PCI. You need to know what your buildings consume in terms of energy. So a typical Vancouver building, about 220 kilowatt hours per square meter per year. And you've got a certain CO2 profile related to that. Some of it comes from BC Hydro because they're about 90% neutral, but they do burn fossil fuels, and some from consumption of fossil fuels such as gas boilers and so on. The best tower to date in Vancouver is 27% below the Model National Energy Code for Canada at about 140 kilowatt hours per square meter. GM Place is the best commercial building that we can design at the moment, given the economic realities, at about 120 or 115 kilowatt hours per square meter. And we are, yes, using some fossil in the BC Hydro because it's ground source, it's electrically driven, not gas driven. So, but there still is a carbon footprint associated with that. We can offset some of that by exporting it to the adjacent building. The amount that we're exporting to the adjacent, the heat we're exporting to the adjacent building, reduces the carbon footprint of that building to a significantly larger amount than this this building consumes. So we're claiming that the building is net neutral.
What's the y-axis?
Energy consumption per square foot.
Yeah,
per square foot. Per square foot. Yeah. So the third example I want to bring to you is Dockside Green. Again, some of you have seen this, and Jennifer is going to speak to the district energy systems in it. So I'll try to gloss over that as best I can in my review of it. I guess the main thing that I want to say is that in just looking at individual buildings, you were only getting a tiny part of the picture. There's so much more we can do in terms of attacking GHG neutral communities. Solutions at the community level than at the building level, and the hint to that is the GM Place project, where we're relying on another building. It's an offset strategy. We're relying on another co-located building. But when you get to the community level, the synergies get much more interesting. And in a way, we all live in communities, whether it's community of offices on your street or buildings on your street, or whether you live at a university or work at a university, or the whole of society can be seen as a series of communities that we can tap into for solutions that share energies to reach a level of efficiency. So this project's in Victoria. Most of you are familiar with it. This slide illustrates why I'm so interested in this idea that we've got to think outside the building at the present time. It's easier to achieve integrated design solutions if you've got more than just the building to consider. You can use the landscape. You can use adjacent buildings. You have some buildings that are emitters and some that are users at different times of day, different times of the season, and different times of types of energy profiles. We're very interested in mixed-use projects at the moment because, you know, retail establishment, a residence, and an office are all completely different in terms of their energy signature, and you can mix those together and move energy from one to another. Well, at the community, you can do the same thing. It allows us to take control of infrastructure money. In all of our communities, we spend vast amounts of money on infrastructure, and it goes unquestioned. The pipes that run in the concrete under us, the systems to distribute, whether it's power or water or sewage, are vastly are very, very expensive, and change become obsolete over time, and they're hard to replace. So if we can find local solutions that solve that, we can take control of that money and put it into the performance of the buildings rather than in the piping necessary to support poor performance. Shared demands create synergies, and as far as I'm concerned at the moment, it's the easiest way to achieve a GHG neutral goal is to look at it at community level. And we can add social responsibility goals, which all environmentalists eventually turn to the question of what's our position in society and what are we doing for the larger picture. So it's a triple bottom line project. It's in the center of Victoria. It encompasses a significant portion of real estate shown here. It's about 1.3 million square feet. There is a balance between working opportunities, living opportunities, retail. There's offices, green sort of blue-collar jobs, a hotel, seniors' residency, even a daycare on site. So there's a very deep concern about balance, creating shared opportunities. Here's the main space on site, which is now the first leg is just being completed, so you can now actually see this on site. This is, of course, a landscape feature, but it's also stormwater detention, bioswale for filtration, and cleaning of gray water as well as stormwater. It features blue-collar jobs as well as living opportunities. The first buildings are now complete with active shading devices on the west and south faces, and an application has been made for platinum certification for this building. These are the strategies that we've employed in the actual building themselves. So it's very efficient systems, but these are commercial strategies. These are not these are not at the level of investment that you saw in the SERS project. This is a commercial project. It's a condo. It's for sale. So you can see numbers and statistics that you wouldn't expect not to find in a project of your own. Lighting power, for example, at 8 watts per square meter is perfectly, state of the art at the moment. It's not particularly revolutionary. So it's a competent and energy efficient building. The greenhouse gas neutral position comes from the distribution systems that are included, and they take their energy source from waste wood. There is a district energy system, and the system produces heat and electricity as an output. I think Jennifer also is going to show this slide, so I'm not going to talk to it, but it's a biomass cogen system on site that produces heat and a little bit of electricity for export off-site. So here's the chart that reflects Dockside. again, measured against ASHRAE 90.1, the building itself performs at 60% better. So again, along with that standard set of buildings that are attainable with standard set of economics at the moment. And then the renewable heat generation on site, the biomass cogen, produces about half of the remaining amount of energy. The remaining electrical load, about half, is then offset with green power certificates on site. So the renewable source, the biomass cogen, deals with the heating load. The lighting load, which is remaining, is dealt with offsets to reach the claim of carbon neutrality. So what have we learned in looking at this? First of all, the threshold to get beyond 50 or 60% improvement is tough. It's tough to get below that. You have to really concentrate, and if you want to make significant improvements down to, say, an 80% performance, you're going to have to invest in the envelope and in the performance of the building at a level that's currently not sustainable in the commercial marketplace, either for residential or commercial buildings. We've learned that we can reach neutrality if we look at, now for the first time, a chart that doesn't just show energy consumption above the zero line, but energy production. Buildings and systems that show energy production. So we've got energy consumption here, and then offsetting dockside green, the district energy system producing energy, and green power certificates offsetting that. So there's an equation between the two. Similarly, GM Place, still energy consumption, and then exporting heat to the adjacent arena, offsetting to zero. SERS, very low consumption, 16%, and then buying a small amount of offsets in the current iteration anyway, off-site, plus having some PV itself. So comparing now some charts, just comparing this to typical building practice and measuring against kilowatt hours per square meter per year for commercial buildings. It's important to distinguish the type of building. Typical BC average, 311 kilowatt hours per square meter. And on the right-hand scale, by the way, measuring using BC's carbon footprint, tons of CO2 per square meter per year, another measure that we're going to have to get used to. I guess I'm giving you a hint as to where LEED Canada is going as well. The next variant of LEED, the next version of LEED Canada, which we're working on at the moment, is going to be all about, you know, performance. You know, not so many credits for this or so many credits for that. You know, how does your building perform? And we'll be measuring both in kilowatt hours per square meter, per use, per bioclimate. You know, we'll average for climate, but we'll also be looking at emissions. So get used to some of these ideas, tons per of CO2 per square meter per year. So you have GM Place at 120. Kilowatt hours per square meter, but the tons per square meter per year in emissions are zero because it's neutral. Our own offices are very energy efficient, but we're not currently offsetting all our emissions on site, so we've got a profile that compares to the BC average reasonably well, although presumably we can do better if we offset that. Interestingly, a four-year-old building that we did, the first LEED Gold building in Canada, new building, is operating very, very efficiently and compares extremely well to what we're doing at the present time. Here's the first little commercial building at Dockside, which will operate at about 72 kilowatt hours per square meter, and again, they're offsetting to zero. And here's SERS, which we hope will operate at around 52 kilowatt hours per square meter. So compare that to the average commercial building in Canada, one-sixth of the energy consumption, and again, offsetting to zero emissions. Residential buildings, same thing. Note here, I've got both BC and Alberta. Alberta, of course, has a dirty footprint in terms of coal-fired stations, whereas we get off a little bit less because of hydro. Doesn't make us better. It's just nature. So they're at 330 kilowatt hours per square meter on average for their residential buildings. Of course, they're colder, so they're consuming more energy. We're at 186 in Canada on average, or sorry, in BC. here's a building in Alberta, a residential building, which is LEED Platinum, finished last year at 198 kilowatts per square meter, and then the carbon footprint associated with that. And here's the first residential building at Dockside at 59 kilowatt hours per square meter. Very, very efficient and offset down to nothing. Last slide here, just to remind you that as far as I'm concerned, it's still important to get the basic decisions right that don't cost any money. Form, orientation, soil orientation, insulation, all the basic strategies that we know about as engineers and architects, get those right. And then look at your passive investments, which cost more money, and get them right. Natural ventilation, thermal mass, ground source, all those kinds of things. And then only, at the risk of reaching perfection, go to the renewables, which cost a lot of money at the moment, as strategies for reaching neutrality. But I wanted to emphasize that finally, because when I see projects that are poorly designed buildings that are covered with photovoltaics, it makes my blood boil. So this is just a reminder to be good first, and then you can have your renewables. That's the end of my presentation. Thank you.